Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We begin today with the other issue raised by the movie theater massacre. We've all talked so much about gun laws since the shooting at the Batman screening, but what about mental health? There's actually a gun law component to this too, which we'll get to. But when does a psychiatrist or anyone else have a duty to notify authorities that someone they know, including a patient, might be at risk for going on a rampage? The main issue that came up at James Holmes' hearing yesterday was patient-psychiatrist confidentiality. So we'll talk to a leading thinker now on ethics, psychology, and the law. He is Paul Applebaum, who teaches and writes about the intersection of law, ethics, and psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Applebaum, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So they tussled in court yesterday over a notebook that Holmes sent to his psychiatrist before the attack. The defense claims it's a confidential communication between doctor and patient that is privileged under the law. Do you understand the argument? Is Holmes' lawyer claiming the court cannot look at that mailing?
Yes, I think in particular the lawyer doesn't want the prosecution to be looking at that mailing and for it to be introduced into evidence. Colorado, like every other state in the country, has a so-called psychotherapist-patient privilege law, which limits the access of third parties, particularly law enforcement and the courts, for that matter, to private communications made in the course of treatment. Some states actually extend these laws to cover all doctor-patient interactions, whether it's psychotherapy or for some other purpose. But the question that is likely to be argued here when the hearing is actually held is whether this communication was for the purpose of treatment. That is, whether the patient, Mr. Holmes, continued to envision that he would be in treatment with his psychiatrist and this communication was in furtherance of it, or whether he, having planned the attack, recognized that he would never again be in contact with her and this was some sort of final farewell.
But what if it was on some level both? If it was kind of an act of patient psychiatrist relationship where he didn't know if he would see her again and was somehow, you know, revealing something of a psychiatric nature to her that in the process acknowledged or somehow hinted at the fact that he might commit this crime. Where, I guess the question is, at what point in general does doctor-client confidentiality as a moral good or a legal good give way to the justice system's need to discover facts after a crime has been committed?
Well, with regard to how these privilege laws are usually applied after the fact, the question for the court will hinge on this question of whether this was part of treatment or not. And the court has a mechanism to help ascertain that, which is that the court can view these records itself, that is, the judge can view the records in camera, in private, in his or her own chambers, and assess whether or not it appears to be related to treatment before making a decision as to whether it should be released to the prosecution.
Now, put yourself in the psychiatrist's shoes. Is it her prerogative to decide to surrender the notebook voluntarily if conscience moves her to do so, even if Holmes' lawyer is fighting that?
Well, practically, my understanding is she doesn't have possession of the notebook right now, so it's less simple than her just turning up at the police station and offering it to them.
Oh, it was seized, so it's just a question of who gets to see it?
That is my understanding. My understanding is actually that the notebook never reached her, that it was intercepted in the mailroom once the university was informed that the notebook was on its way.
Oh, I think you're right, because the original reporting about the notebook was that, he may have tipped somebody off here and maybe this was preventable, but it never reached her.
Right, and it's not even clear, at least from the public reports, when this was actually mailed. Could have been put in the mailbox while he was on his way to the theater. At this point, we just don't know that.
Okay, so let's leave the notebook aside now. You wrote a journal article in the 80s called Therapists' Obligations to Report Their Patients' Criminal Acts. And I was surprised to read in that article last night that only one state considers it a crime to not report a criminal act, that the law sees that differently from actively covering something up. Can you explain the distinction as the justice system sees it?
Sure. Going back to medieval times in English law, there was a crime of which you could be accused called misprision of a felony, which meant that you had knowledge of a felony and failed to reveal it to the authorities. Actually, the law came in with the Norman invasion of England, and most people view it as a technique for the minority Normans to control their larger rest of Anglo-Saxon population by compelling them to inform on each other. Over time in this country, misprision has fallen away as a crime. Many states have revoked their statutes, and even in states where they're still on the books, the likelihood is that it would not stand up to court scrutiny. At least that's what most legal scholars agree. So it's not just a psychiatrist who doesn't have an obligation to report a crime that comes to his or her attention. And that's actually true for all of us.
So something changed from medieval times to today about our notion of justice.
Something changed about our notion of the fairness of compelling people at their own hazard to report crimes that come to their attention. We have come to believe that that is not a fair requirement. People, of course, are still free to report those crimes if they choose to. But to turn them into criminals for failing to act is something that we over time have rejected.
So that's the law. What about best practices under psychiatry ethics? Let's say James Holmes had gotten away, but then admitted in therapy that he was the movie theater killer. What would a psychiatrist be expected to do in your profession?
Well, that's a much more difficult question, as you can imagine. Psychiatrists hear confessions of all sorts from their patients, from personal crimes, if you will, adultery, lying to a spouse, maybe taking small amounts of money from the business for which they work, to much more serious offenses, including murder at times. In general, the ethics of the profession encourage us to keep patients' communications confidential unless others are apparently threatened by the patient. So if a patient, for example, confessed that he was a serial killer who had killed five people and was likely to kill again, that is not something that a psychiatrist would typically keep to him or herself, because it suggests that there are other likely victims in the future. On the other hand, for someone who confesses that 20 years ago he embezzled some amount of money from an employer but has gone straight ever since, that's a contrasting situation where I think a psychiatrist would not and should not reveal that information.
Listeners, any people in the psychotherapy field listening now, whether you are a psychiatrist or psychologist, social worker, whatever, and have been in this position of someone having confessed to you a crime, or of you being concerned that one of your patients or clients might be about to commit a crime, even to hurt people physically, what did you do? What do you think you should be required to do or not? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Paul Applebaum, who teaches and writes about the intersection of law, ethics, and psychiatry at Columbia University. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I guess, Dr. Applebaum, there's a question as to where the line is. And again, we don't know how much James Holmes revealed to his psychiatrist in this case in advance. But what about if a client gave a psychiatrist an indication that he might be about to commit murder, or that he's so unstable and having violent fantasies or whatever that he might just be at serious risk of committing murder? Then what's the psychiatrist to do?
So the ethics of the profession, as they've evolved over the last 40 to 50 years, are pretty clear in that situation. If you truly believe that others are endangered by a patient, or if the patient, him or herself, is endangered, that is, that they're suicidal and likely to try to take their own lives, you have an obligation to do something to try to stop that from happening. That's a recognized ethical obligation, and there are ways in which the law has insisted on that as well. Unfortunately, those cases where it's clear-cut that a person intends harm to others are relatively rare. What's much more common is for a patient to come into the office, talk in vague terms about their anger at the world, their fantasies of getting back at people, never quite making it into a concrete threat, never quite reaching that point where you're sure that they represent an imminent or even fairly proximal danger. Those are the tough cases to deal with.
Indeed. And we have a lot of people in the profession calling up. We'll start to take your calls in just a minute, and we'll also get into where this does actually intersect with gun laws. For example, in New Jersey, if you want a gun, apparently you have to fill out an application that includes whether you've ever been treated by a psychiatrist and waive any talk of confidentiality about that. So we'll talk to Dr. Applebaum about that. We'll take some of your calls as we talk about the intersection of psychiatry, law, ethics, and gun rights in the case of James Holmes. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Paul Applebaum, who teaches and writes about the intersection of law, ethics, and psychiatry at Columbia University. And we're talking about patient-psychiatrist privilege in the James Holmes movie theater massacre case and other questions relevant to psychiatry and mental health. As I said at the beginning of the segment, the media has focused, including us, so much on the gun law questions that have come out of this shooting. But there are all these mental health questions also, including some policy-related ones, and we're exploring some of those now. Peter in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. Many years ago, I'm a psychologist, and I think it was in the 70s, I was seeing a patient who told me, he said it was I was the first person he told, other than his mother, that he had killed somebody. That was freaking me out a little bit, and I went to see an attorney who has worked in this area, and basically he said the same thing your guest said, that if this person is a danger in the present, I need to report it. If it's something in the past and the book is sort of closed and his life is different, I need to keep it to myself. And his life was different. He had been a junkie back then. He was involved with a whole group of people in a crazy scene.
So you kept it confidential,
yeah,
and you have felt okay about it to this day?
Yeah. I have no idea what happened to him after I stopped seeing him, but his life, he'd been a totally different life style.
But it was a murder for which no one was brought to justice, right?
As far as I know, yeah. His claim was that this guy was abusing him and they were in some sort of fight over things. This was many years ago. I don't remember everything.
Right. Peter, I'm going to leave it there and get some other folks on. But your story is clear, and it's the same place that Dr. Applebaum, you were saying, the the line is earlier in terms of patient-client privilege and what's, I mean, patient-psychiatrist privilege and what's generally considered best practice. If the person has really moved on from there and is not seen by you as being a threat in the future, then maybe the best practice is you do keep the past crime between the two of you, even if it is a murder. You feel a little squeamish, though, hearing that story?
I would say, in addition, that the therapist has an obligation to work with the patient to find out what the patient wants to have happen. There are some patients who feel so ridden by guilt or concerned about injustice, perhaps other people having been convicted for a crime that they actually committed, that their ultimate desire is to confess and to face justice and some sanction. And if that's what the patient truly desires, the therapist can help the patient work toward that end.
Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I want to ask Dr. Applebaum something about the prosecution's reason for wanting the diary now. It seems to me that as this goes forward, the probability of a psychiatric defense being put forward by the defense is great. And if so, this diary would become available as any and all information concerning his past psychiatric history would. So isn't this really just some kind of ploy for them to get their hands on it first, to be able to look at something that might give them a way of interfering with or preparing or diminishing the possibility of a defense?
Dr. Applebaum, go ahead.
Well, I'd be reluctant to read the mind of the prosecutor in Colorado. What I can tell you from my experience with these kinds of cases is that it's fairly standard practice for prosecutors' offices to want to get as much of the documentary information as they possibly can in every case, whether there's an issue of privilege or not. If they know something exists, they want to go after it because they don't know what it contains, and it may help their case.
Right. And to Steve's point, they don't need the notebook to establish that James Holmes committed the crime. There's lots of other physical evidence to that effect. It would be relevant, presumably, to an argument over, you know, an insanity defense. Now, you were quoted in the press on the Anders Breivik case in Norway. He was the mass murderer who killed more than 70 people, for people who don't remember, first in Oslo and then at a summer camp all on the same day. And you said that Breivik could be found insane even if he meticulously planned his massacre. Why would those two things be consistent?
Because there are people who are driven to commit crimes, including murder, by their mental illnesses. Often paranoid-style delusions, conspiracy theories about the world, who are nonetheless able to meticulously plan the crimes that they commit and carry them out in a very systematic way. Their delusional structure is fairly well contained, tends not to permeate other aspects of their lives, but drives them inexorably in that direction. So although prosecutors like to argue that planful acts suggest that this was a crime for which the insanity defense is not relevant, that's actually not always the case.
Steve in Greenwich Village, you're on WNYC. Hello, Steve.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Just anecdotal, my late stepfather was a child psychiatrist, and at an early age in his career was the director of the Texas Student Health Department at the University of Texas. And one of his subordinates was the person who interviewed Charles Joseph Whitman in the spring of 1966. And he said not only was it a lapse not to inform in a timely fashion, but since he ended up killing over 32 people, it wrecked his career.
In other words, the Austin Tower sniper had spoken to him previously, and what? There were clues there, and he didn't pick them up?
Well, he did not. He was not the psychiatrist. It was someone under his
supervision.
Direction.
Uh-huh.
And there was a quite lengthy report that came out about all of this. Afterhand, and at that point, it was pretty well determined that in Texas, and I have no idea where it's gone since then. That, you know, there is, if you believe there is a threat, that you are bound to report, or it's a crime.
Was Texas the one state in your report, Dr. Applebaum, where you were bound to report in different ways than other states?
No, and I suspect that what the caller's stepfather was concerned with was less criminal liability than the possibility of civil liability, that is, of being sued for failure to reveal information that he may have had or thought that he should have had.
Thank you for your call. And I think on the other side of that is Jackie in Brooklyn, who's a social worker. Jackie, you're on WNYC, and I think you want to articulate another reason not to report, right?
Well, it's not about not reporting. It's about what happens to folks that you think might be about to either commit a crime or hurt themselves or somebody else. The idea that I think that we just, as outpatient social workers or therapists, then hospitalize folks, we have to really look at what happens during those hospitalizations, the likelihood that people are going to receive proper care. Because oftentimes, once somebody goes into a psychiatric hospital, they're held for 2 or 3 days, and then there's a bunch of pressure on them, on the doctors and the staff, to release them as soon as possible.
Right.
And so oftentimes, even when you do report these issues, folks aren't given the proper care and are often back out not receiving the care that they need in a pretty quick amount of time.
So therefore what? Why bother?
Not why bother, but I think we need to look at the mental health system as a whole, and especially the folks that have the most serious and persistent mental health issues, and look at the way that they're getting long-term care. Because our idea right now of how we treat those people, especially people who are poor, is that we give them these short little psychiatric hospital stays, and then they're back out on the street and not necessarily always getting proper follow-up
mm-hmm.
care. And so I know, in America, the idea of sort of moving away from institutionalization into this community health practice has really backfired in a lot of ways, because we don't have proper long-term care for people mm-hmm. with persistent mental health issues.
Important. All of that. I'm glad you brought it up. We're almost out of time, Dr. Applebaum, but on the intersection of the mental health question and the gun law question, I read that in New Jersey, if you want a gun, you have to apply to the police and fill out an application that includes whether you have ever been treated by a psychiatrist and to waive all confidentiality around that. Are you familiar with New Jersey's law?
Yes, I am. It's the handgun application, which asks whether you've ever been attended, treated, or observed by any doctor or psychiatrist, whether at a hospital or on an outpatient basis, for any mental or psychiatric condition. And if you respond affirmatively, you have to provide the name and location of that person and waive your right of confidentiality if you still want a handgun, so that they can access medical information about your treatment.
Would I be right to assume that Colorado doesn't have that in its gun laws?
I'm not aware that they do, although I will tell you that New York has a similar provision in its handgun application as well.
Is it a common standard, and is it something that the psychiatry profession in general supports?
Well, it's something that that I would support. I don't know that I can speak for the whole profession, but it is just one more way of screening out those people who may, as a result of mental disorder, although there are a minority of people who commit criminal offenses, but who may be the kind of person you wouldn't want to have a handgun.
Mental health issues as they relate to the James Holmes case and others. Paul Applebaum, who teaches and writes about the intersection of law, ethics, and psychiatry at Columbia University. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.